listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore.
You are listening to Sound Poetry from Radio Tacoma, KTAH, 101.9 LPFM. I'm your host, Steve Niebel, sitting in for David Gilmore, who is currently on hiatus. Today we welcome poet Penelope Schott of Portland, or is it Dufour? Penelope Scambly Schott is the author of a novel and several books of poetry. She was awarded 4 New Jersey Arts Fellowships before moving to Oregon, where her verse biography, A is for Anne, Mistress Hutchinson Disturbs the Commonwealth, received an Oregon Book Award for poetry. Several of Penelope's books and individual poems have won other prizes. Her individual poems have appeared in APR, Georgia Review, Nimrod, and elsewhere. Penelope has enjoyed fellowships at Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, Massachusetts, the Vermont Studio Center in Johnson, Vermont, and the Wurlitzer Foundation in Taos, New Mexico. Professionally, she has sold cosmetics at Macy's in Herald Square, made whole wheat donuts at Scrumpy's Cider Mill, taken care of the elderly as a certified home health aide, written scripts for software on career guidance, posed as an artist model, and as punishment for her PhD in late medieval English literature, spent years and years teaching college literature and writing creative courses. Penelope and her husband live in Portland, Oregon, where they host a series of poetry readings called the White Dog Salon, although she and the actual white dog have an alternate life in which they spent part of each week in the small wheat-growing town of Dufour, where she teaches an annual poetry workshop from a house in Dufour. Penelope can see the east side of Mount Hood, the high school football scoreboard, and the Milky Way. In 2013, she published 2 books which are quite different from each other, a sweet tribute called Love Song for Dufour, which she read at the Old Balch Hotel in Dufour and sold to all the locals who want their grown kids to move back, and a relentless but sometimes hilarious historical study of prostitution called Lily Was a Goddess. Lily Was a Whore, for which Penelope had trouble booking readings. Her 2014 collection, How I Became an Historian, is a lyrical examination of the connections between past and future, both in her family and in a larger world. Most recent, published in 2018, is House of the Cardamom Seed. This book is divided into 4 sections: In the House of the Cardamom Seed, In the House of Lusts, In the House of the Throat, In the House of Wander. In the kind words of poet Alicia Ostriker, "You never know what you will find when you turn the next page of this book, but you know it will be startling and precious daylight. Consider yourself warm." So, welcome, Penelope Schott.
Well, thank you, Steve. And I should add that my 2 most recent books, one is called On Dufour Hill, because I climb Dufour Hill every day with my dog. And the other is actually co-written with my dog, and it is called Sophia and Mr. Walter Whitman. Sophia is a very fine poet, but she only has paws, so I had to do the typing. And she is a great admirer of Walt Whitman, but she doesn't think he always gets it right. So now you're up to date on all the trouble I've been in.
Is paws a double entendre?
It could be. It so could also be Papa's paws.
There we go. So why don't we start off with a poem?
Okay. At the Great Feast. I was born in my early 20s, babies and all. In my late 30s, love cracked me loose. In middle age, it was safe to go mad. So now I know what the owl knows. The silent swoop, a warm and flightless crunch, how every night the mouse herself says, yes. I can give you another autobiographical one if you want.
I had to ask myself, who is the mouse?
I think I'm the mouse.
Oh, really? You're the.
And I'm saying yes to everything.
I've heard of this, of creatures that in a certain regard welcome the predator to pick them up by something that some creatures eat will make them evident to their predators. And so in that respect, welcome their predator. That was the thought that went through my head.
Okay, well, I guess you get to a certain age where you say yes to everything.
Really? Do you really say yes to everything?
Almost. I'm trying to teach myself to say no. When I moved from New Jersey to Oregon, I had to resign from 19 committees.
Wow.
So I'm being a little more selective what I say yes to, but you know, that might be interesting, so I do it.
What they say is that if you want to get something done, pick out somebody who's the busiest person you know.
Yeah.
Why don't you read us another one?
All right. Well, this, in a way, is another confessional autobiography. Fair warning. A woman like me is not to be messed with. She will smother you with such kindness, you will not guess why you bleed. A woman, like the woman I am, keeps every vow. Even the words you never spoke, she will remember forever. My sort of woman is only sometimes a woman. She is the divariate root of a single wheat stalk. Or else she is bedrock. Don't you forget this. To marry a woman like me is to dream in the bed of the ocean, is to marry the flammable air.
I really like that bed of the ocean and the flammable air. That really intrigued me. You sound a little bit scary there.
I hope so.
But that even the words you never spoke, she will remember forever. If you're the person you're speaking about, you are treading on thin ice. You know, you just don't know where you're going to break through. Where did you find the word divariate?
I read about wheat.
Okay.
And they have a route that goes in different directions.
I figured that out, but it just seemed to me like maybe you were looking for a word that was not in much usage. But you know, poets are like that. They like words, right?
Yeah.
So they find a word. They go, oh, well, I think I can use that one. I think I'll put that one in, right?
Well, I've been told that when I was a little kid in a crib, that I just said words over and over again,
mm-hmm.
just because I liked the sound of them.
Oh, you told me a story about your first poem when I was talking to you the other day.
Yeah. Well, that was the first poem I wrote down. There were all the poems I wrote before then that I had to dictate to somebody because I didn't know how to write yet.
Tell us about that first poem.
Well, I lived in Manhattan on the 13th floor on the Upper West Side, and there were, across the street from me, and therefore below me, were some six-story buildings. They were six-story walk-ups. I think you weren't allowed to build a building higher than six stories without an elevator. So I was looking at them, and I was a little kid. I was probably five or six. I sometimes can't remember where I parked my car, but I do remember this poem, and it goes as follows. Sad little skyscraper on a New York City street, if only it could grow a few more feet, then it would be tall and could reach the sky and wouldn't be thought of as small at all. I think that I maybe was identifying with the little building.
Well, that's delightful. You were six. You were around 6 years old when you wrote
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, see, no wonder you're still writing poetry and other things.
Well, I had a grandmother who used to read poetry at night on the porch. And she would read these beautiful Robert Burns love poems. And my grandfather would sit there and belch. It was quite lovely.
Moving right along, let's have another poem.
I go to Portland often enough to see that our homeless problem is pretty sad. And this is called Tonight Over in Portland. Even here in the country, the rain can slash, winds gust, trees bend, pine cones pound my metal roof. Have I mentioned how much I love my roof? Or shall I describe cardboard under sleeping bags, shopping carts heaped with soaked clothes, meager windscreen of a dumpster, a wet dog under the only quilt? Can I say how chilly the rain? In that whole liberal city, not enough hot soup.
I like that. We have a huge homeless community here in Tacoma as well, and many of them are in our neighborhood. And so I see this a lot. I don't know any of these people. They are anonymous faces that I see when I drive past them. And I know that it's so easy to judge. Of course, there's been a lot of publicity. I just wonder how deep the tragedy is for all of these different people. It makes me wonder, where do they come from? How do they get there? What happens is these communities spring up and they get bigger and they kind of establish themselves, and they'll be there for a while, and then finally the people who live in the area will get upset about it and then they
sweep them out and they go somewhere else.
Right, that's right, yeah.
It's hard. I talk occasionally when I'm in Portland. I buy the Street News, which is a homeless paper. Mm-hmm. And I usually buy from the same person regularly. Mm-hmm. And we have a wee bit of a conversation, but it doesn't really go deep.
Right.
You know, yeah. Just enough to say, I know you're a human being.
I also wonder what it says about us, you know, about the rest of us who are not homeless. Those of us who have, and why should anybody have to live on the street? That's the question that comes up in my head.
Yeah, but I think a lot of us have family members who would be in the street if we didn't help them out.
Right.
So it's easy to imagine. When I was a young divorced mother desperately trying to finish my PhD, I was real grateful for that roof.
So, another poem.
Another poem. All right. Well, I have a wonderful husband. His name is Eric Sweetman, and he is a sweet man almost always. But this poem is for him. Dear repair technician, my husband is not operating properly. When he drives, he doesn't speak. Or if he does, he says, "That's a Tesla." In bed, when I want my feet rubbed, his hands will drift up to my breasts. If he slices strawberries for cereal, the stems remain in the kitchen sink. Also, he watches too much television. He has not malfunctioned politically, for which I am grateful, and affection is still reliable. Call with an estimate. If marriage came with a warranty, I believe it has long since expired. Any minor improvement in function will be appreciated, as I do not plan on replacing him. Sincerely yours.
I really enjoyed that, reading it. That speaks well for a good relationship that you can publish something like that, and that he'll smile when he reads it.
Yeah, well, I'm sure I do a million stupid little things that are equally annoying as leaving the strawberry stems in the sink.
Yeah.
You know, high crimes and misdemeanors all around. I have another one about him.
Okay.
This is called Why We Sleep With Our Dog. When I place my lips on top of my husband's springy gray hair, I can never taste what he's thinking. When my hand tries to circle his thick tendoned wrist, distance ticks under my fingertips. If I were some solitary beast in a forest, I'd howl for my pack of tail-whomping, slobber-tongued dogs, for dogs matted with burrs. I'd follow those pathways on earth where animals step, and I'd enter the dens where they curl. All my life, it's been so lonesome just being human, nearing the men who don't talk, wandering around with a head full of words. But when I pet the dog, while my husband pets the dog, and the dog stretches and sighs, bunching up the covers like she always does, and when his fingers and my fingers meet in her fur, then I am touching respite. Then we are married.
That's really a nice resolution.
Well, you know, we say she's our court jester, our marriage counselor, our easy kid.
And a poet to boot.
And a poet to boot, yes.
I noticed that you've been labeled a feminist poet.
Yeah. Years ago in the 70s, I was teaching someplace where Adrienne Rich was teaching, and it was actually very interesting because they would have these raging feminist meetings where I would get in trouble because I had to go home at 6 o'clock because I had to get the kids from the person who was watching them. And then years later, I'm not talking about Adrienne Rich, but other people in my department there, you know, they had put off pregnancy, and then they were all trying to get pregnant in their 30s after having given me a hard time for being a bad feminist for going home to my kids.
Mm-hmm.
It was a funny period.
Yeah, I just watched a documentary about feminists, and it was really interesting. I thought that one of the statements it made, it was a black feminist who was saying, well, she used to they used to talk about the white feminist, you know, and it was a very
upper middle class white thing,
right?
Yeah,
right. Well, you could see this in this documentary is that these people were not struggling, but she said, but you know, it was white women who were in the abolitionist movement, and she said, and you know why that was? It was because they were slaves also.
Interesting.
Which I thought was a really interesting statement. I think that feminism has not lost its place in the world at all. I think that it's a struggle that continues.
Well, I think the real statement is women are human beings and equally deserving of choosing as men are. So it's not really a very radical statement.
No. Well, it shouldn't be, but you know, there are a lot of things that we say that we think are not radical, that other people think are just insane. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of things that I think are not radical. I don't think of myself as being a radical, but in a lot of crowds, I would be considered to be radical.
You know, I've published in feminist publications. I taught at a women's college. I care very deeply about the rights of women. And I care about the rights of women in the same way that I care about the rights of men, that everybody should have their rights.
Right. Absolutely. Well, you can't go wrong to saying that. Well, we should have some poetry from your dog. I think that reading that, I thought that your dog spoke very well for other dogs too, actually.
Well, my dog likes to quote Whitman. Uh-huh. So there's a little bit of Whitman in each of her poems.
Okay.
And the quote, this poem is called "When People Call Me Bad Dog." Mm-hmm. And the quote is, "I am as bad as the worst, but thank God I am as good as the best." When people call me bad dog, any dumb hen should have known I can run faster. Okay, I admit it. I am as bad as the worst, but thank God, or dog. I am as good as the best, most especially at running. So if I wasn't supposed to kill those stupid chickens, why did they run? Contrition. About the chickens. It got bad. The chicken lady came over and cried. I wanted to lick her hand. Instead, I curled up into a small ball on the floor and went to sleep. The thing about dogs is, and this is the quote, they do not lie awake in the dark and weep for their sins. Still, that whole night, I didn't jump up on my people's bed. I didn't press my spine against her back. I didn't poke my muzzle into her hand, not even for 5 minutes. Walter understands. He also says I should call him Walt because we're such close friends. Walt tells me, "These are the days that must happen to you." Except it wasn't day, it was night. And oh, such a long night. When the coyotes howled on the hill, I felt like a chicken. My dog is not perfect. No, I just keep her on a leash in town and wait till we get out in the fields. And if they're calves, I don't let her go.
Right.
Well, this is people's living.
Right. Well, of course, I thought that I really enjoyed those poems because I could relate to them.
You knew about it.
I knew how that dog felt.
Well, here's another doofer poem, and it's a Christmas poem. I know we've just finished Halloween. All is calm, all is bright. Our town has lit the big star on Doofer Hill, its heavy orange extension cord draping across snow crust. Below, in lit houses, we all cook supper. Good smells season our rooms. Even the poorest neighbors will eat. I hope they won't turn on their huge TVs to hear about one family in a distant war where rescue agencies can't go. An unseen family, their young children, shiver together beside a makeshift stove welded from galvanized scrap. All the chairs gone. That family is burning their leather shoes. The shoes of children offer little heat.
Yeah. that last line is really powerful. That really does get to you. It's but I thought it was interesting that how even a town of 600, their Christmas is so important to them that in every town all around this country there's a big Christmas tree that is sponsored by the municipality.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I wonder what would happen if they put a Muslim sign on top of the hill. I don't think that would go over very well. Or even a Star of David.
Well, eventually there'll be a large enough Muslim population in this country so that they will be a much more visible population than they currently are. And I think that it depends upon where you are too, because if I'm not mistaken,
Or like places like Michigan, that's huge.
I'm guessing I'm seeing Afghanistan, but it could be Syria.
It could be a lot of places.
Right.
Well, let me read you something else that's a little like that. Memorial Day in Dufour. I know it's not Memorial Day, it's Veterans Day, but my husband was in Vietnam. We're very aware of it. Memorial Day in Dufour. The hill is blue lupin, and the meadowlark trills from the highest point above our peaceful town. On Main Street, the grand marshal of the parade rides by in a Model T, sporting his World War II medals. In the cemetery down the road, other soldiers sleep under packed dirt. Nobody has told them how all those young men are still out there dying, how they keep dying and dying all over the world in every month of the year. I think each blue hill or valley or delta or prairie is home to someone. Why can't they stay home, being happy and well? I was close friends with a guy who was written up in Collier's magazine because he went across enemy territory to carry big guns, and he survived. And he died a couple of years ago at age 97, but he every now and then would turn to me and say, "I'm going to tell you something I never told anybody." And then he'd tell me some god-awful story about dead bodies on barbed wire or something. And he and his wife have graves next to our plots up in the Dufour Cemetery. And we always talked about how when we were all dead, we would, on Friday nights, we would climb out of our graves and drink wine together. So I miss him.
So let's move along. Let's have another poem.
Well, I have two left that I sent to you. One of them is about Dufour, and one of them I don't know what it's about. You want to hear them both?
Sure.
Okay. This is a excuse me. This is a farm community, and one of the courses at this high school is an agriculture course. So this is ag class in the Dufour School parking lot. Our March wind is still chilly, and the mountain bright white beyond the end of the valley, but wheat is greening on the hills. This morning, during second period, 17 skinny 10th graders, no jackets, no hats, wait to drive a small Kubota diesel front loader. These are the kids, the grandkids, neighbors of farmers and ranchers. They practice doing turns and rows. The machine gleams bright orange. Too soon, the buzzer for class over will buzz an end to this happy dance. The teacher will turn off the engine and watch the kids struggle inside, their cheeks still shining. For once, they love each other and their town. The class could be named Civics or else Phys Ed or even Geometry, but I propose we ought to call it Art. So everybody here knows a farmer or is a farmer.
Well, that's interesting. So there's actually a class where they drive heavy machinery?
Yes, in the parking lot.
Well, I'm sure you have a couple of more poems to read somewhere there.
Well, I have one other that I sent to you and another that I just finished yesterday. So maybe I should read them.
That's right. I think that's a good idea.
Okay. And then you'll be up to date. All right. This is a little one about childhood. Does the brook remember a girl with pigtails rearranging its rocks? Or was she a fish, slick and transparent? She piled up stones to deepen the stream, but still the water kept flowing away. No, it's no wonder she couldn't float then. Yes, this is the wonder. I'm floating now. Say something new about November. Nothing new. 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, the end of World War I. I was 11 and stood with my young mother in that railroad car on the siding back where in 1918 they signed the armistice. I was 21. A new mother, scarcely able to mother myself, that November 22nd when JFK was murdered. This November, I expect nothing, not peace or murder, birth or death. I should go outside and rake up my fallen leaves. I'll stand under the cottonwood. I'll rake and rake and rake and stuff leaves into a sack. Every leaf is yellow and brown. My bag will keep wanting to tilt over. I won't let it, I won't let it, I won't let it. So that brings you up to the moment.
You mentioned being in that armistice car where that was signed. That was really an end to a real horror show, which hasn't, unfortunately, ended.
No, I also found out years later that was where Hitler made the French surrender in World War II, which I didn't know at the time.
Well, thank you for reading for sound poetry. I've really enjoyed our chat. And
well, it was a pleasure hanging out with you.
You've been listening to Sound Poetry with Penelope Schott of Duver, Oregon. It's been a great pleasure having you here today, Penelope.
Thank you.